Or as I do with Joshy, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. Joshy calls it the jazzy version when he's in bed. He goes, jazzy version, jazzy version. That's what he says. And I know he means me singing that. And he loves it. And then he goes, and when I go, oh, he goes, bom, bom. I swear that's what he does.
Your son knows shit about jazz. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting to my right is your co-host, Ian Mond.
Thank you for giving me a moment to say hello. I didn't do that last
no,
night.
No, you didn't.
No.
No.
Sorry.
Moving on. And this month we have two special guests, but don't worry, we're not reviewing four books. Stop panicking. sitting across from us, I have Lisa Hannett.
Hello.
That's perfect, Lisa. That's great mic technique. And Ms. Angela Slater.
Doctor.
Yes, doctor. Thank you very much.
Can't you be Ms. and
no,
Doctor?
No. You're once both, you earn that doctor.
You're both doctors. Yeah. You're both doctors.
Good evening.
The doctor's the good doctor's evening. Brain.
Why is it Slater as it's only got – it's got two T's, not one?
I had a very angry grandmother who used to insist that it was pronounced Slater, and she would tell shop assistants the accent was on the A, and she would get extremely upset if anyone pronounced it otherwise. I don't know why this was, but we all just buckled down and pronounced our name that way, and we continue to do it because no one wants the shade of an angry granny coming after them for mispronunciation or a correct pronunciation, as the case may be.
Yeah, because everyone calls you Slater, don't they?
Generally, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this podcast will end that once and for all. It's Slater.
All our 73 and a half listeners.
It's more than that, Kirsten. You won't let me tell you how many it is. I did just do a check. Anyway, not relevant.
Not relevant.
No. So please ask a question of the two lovely ladies. Oh, we should. Can we say where we are? Because this is the first time we've ever done it in a hotel room.
That is the first time we have recorded a podcast in a hotel room.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't mean like sex. I mean recording a podcast. Yeah.
Very subtle.
Yeah. Thanks. It is, and it's a nice little place in the city. I don't know if I'd recommend it, but it's pretty good.
From one room.
I like the hallway. Is written off.
You love the corridor.
The corridor's purple.
Yeah. Anyway, but this is the first, and it's a pretty relaxed atmosphere. And do you want to ask them a question? I mean, I have a million, but I don't want to take away your question asking because that would be rude.
Are you done?
Yeah, I am. I'll be quiet.
I'm going to ask them about the book that you're co-writing together for Ticonderoga, and how is that going?
Well, it is due at the end of the month. It's coming along really well. It's called Midnight and Moonshine, a collection of interconnected short stories.
Or a mosaic novel, as the case may be.
Well, is it actually interconnected as in it's set in the one place with one character running through the whole lot?
Set in the one place as in Earth.
With some recurring characters, but it's kind of generational.
Which is actually interesting in light of the books that we're reading.
Someone's been reading Michael Crummy. Come on.
Well, it does have that feel. It starts off sort of in the 9th century and goes all the way through to the 20th century.
Someone's bringing Alan Moore.
Yeah.
Can we read the first chapter of your book, or is that just going to make our brains explode?
No, you can actually read it.
we'll get to that later in the podcast, listeners.
Our writing is very accessible.
The stories are interconnected in that they lead logically to the next one. And yeah, there are some recurring characters, but it's not Alan Moore-ish kind of recurring character.
We will get to that later.
Yeah.
So are you doing alternate chapters sort of deal, or is it a bit more than that.
No, we do them all together. So we sort of discuss, you know, if we're inspired to do one of the stories. I'll go, oh, I know how I want to start that one. So I'll start it and then pass it on to Angela. And she'll add to it and then go, okay, I'm stumped. Now it's your turn. And we'll take turns. Or she'll go, oh, I have this excellent idea, and write a couple thousand words and then go, okay, now it's your turn. So we swap them back and forth and then chop and change and rewrite what the other person has
so written. It's sort of a round robin, but you plan out in advance what the story is going to be.
Yeah, we plan ideas out, and cool things and, you know, stuff like someone needs to
do bloody blah.
Yes, steal the skin of an old woman in order to escape somewhere, you know. And
yes,
you do,
indeed,
and
that does happen.
And you think of all the things that you want to include in the story. So, you know,
we sat down and planned out the whole story arc for the whole book. And then some of the individual stories we have left a little bit more loose so that we can say, okay, we know it has to have these characters in it. It should be talking about this sort of gist. Run with it and see with you know.
I'm fascinated here. This is fascinating me, which is good because it means I'm not bored. But
you're less distracted. Yeah, you're not bored.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, but only in the sense that so you would write half a paragraph or five paragraphs and go, yeah, I'll just give that now to Angela. Yeah. Even though, so you haven't written a full story. Haven't even probably even written the first section of a story. You just.
Well, it depends. Like some of them, you'll write a couple of sections, or you write half of the story.
Yeah.
Or I think for one of them, one each, I think we kind of wrote the whole story
and then
sent it to the other person, then added, changed, deleted things. But most of the time it's kind of write a chunk and then, oh, I've got some ideas for the end, but I don't really know how we connect the beginning to the end. So I'll just write those ideas and then pass it on. You fill in the gap, you pass it back. Mm. And then if it's like, oh, no, I'm not really sure about that, delete, rewrite that part. So it ends up becoming this kind of amorphous thing that in the end ends up.
Perfect. We did
an award winner. I would hope.
We did a post for Book Life Now actually on collaboration and on our process and what was it five points about collaboration.
Yeah.
Just to give people an idea of how it went back and forth and.
Because people are often surprised about that, but I think it's because we trust each other's writing. I trust that. If I've written something and Angela doesn't like it and rewrites it or finds that it needs a tweaking for whatever reason, I don't feel like she's going to make it shit.
Which is a big thing.
A really big thing. It's not like you can't just do that with anybody and say, here, take my story, which I've just spent the past 4 days working on, and change it, and it'll be fine. You know, so because we trust each other's writing, we can actually do it without jabbing each other's eyes out when things are changed.
And if she's made it worse,
then you have a discussion.
Yeah. I think track changes makes this possible.
Oh god, you don't really use track changes,
yeah,
do you?
Totally.
We absolutely do.
Comments, Orama, yes. And track changes.
How do you read the bloody thing? Because it'll have
you look at final version or final with markup. Mm. And so when you look at final with markup, it is a bunch of red and, you know, screaming changes everywhere. But if you just read the final version first, then you can
clean
follow the
page.
Story. Yeah.
Oh.
And then you can always switch the markup on to see what's changed.
Sometimes we have quite detailed, we have a lot of very detailed comments on why we've done this in a particular way, and because we're also both quite paranoid about repetitions in text and we do tend to take them out as a matter of course, that if we're doing an intentional series of repetitions and we'll mark it for the other one just in case we miss it, you know, it's just to say, actually, this is why I've done this rather than
I'm trying to avoid repeating blah, so if you have a better word, then please replace it or whatever, comments like that.
So a large number of our comments, our conversations are had in the comments field of story.
And you're still having fun, yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
Actually, it sounds really cool. It sounds like having another self that you can go, you fix that.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is.
Like that.
A little pixie that just writes it for you.
Where you just go, I just don't know how it's
like
going to get there.
Just, you do it.
Please, I imagine them ending up here. Here, please.
Yes. Get the word hoard is empty. It's your turn.
Yeah, it's actually excellent. That's great when you're stumped.
I've read two stories that you've written together. One was A February Dragon and one was I can't remember the name, but in
Prohibition Blues.
And they're both it's interesting because if it was just one of your names on the story, I'd go, yeah, oh yeah, that's Angela's story. Or that's clearly that's written by them. Like, there's no real differentiation or anything. It just seems it could have been written by either of you. So your voices must just blend beautifully.
I think by the time we get to the final draft, we've rewritten and added things so many times that, there are still parts where I'll go, oh, I remember writing that because, oh, I remember that metaphor or something. But even by the end, when we're looking at the final draft, we're kind of like, oh, I can't even remember which part was yours and which part was mine. It's just when we write stories together, I think we tend to go over them a lot more than our solo stories where you can sit there and agonize and go in order and, spend a long time getting it correct the first time. But with our joint stories, it's like, here's another one, draft number 7, draft number 8.
Right. What do you think of this now?
But it does end up as a seamless third voice.
It definitely does,
which works nicely, because our writing when we're writing separately is very different. Sourdough and bluegrass are very, very different. You wouldn't mistake them for each other, but once we're in the zone, when we're writing together and doing that collaboration, then there is that third, that third voice.
What does working with Ticonderoga give you, like in terms of just artistic creativity side of things?
I think we're allowed to do a book like this, which is very different. We're allowed to
pitch the idea
of a mosaic novel and not have someone go, no, that won't sell, which you would get if you were working with the bigger houses. So we can do something that's a bit more boutique. And we're both fairly bossy, so we tend to beat Russell up and insist upon having, a different cover or something like that.
Yes.
Well, did you choose the cover for Bluegrass?
Yes, I did choose it.
Because that's gorgeous.
You made the cover for Bluegrass.
Oh, that's what you made. When you say you made it...
So, by made it, I mean we found an image and tinkered with it until it looked the way we wanted.
Okay.
So,
did you have to buy that image?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I say we because, it was a joint effort. Russell, did all of the fonts and everything like that on the cover. So, I do like the cover. It turned out the way that I wanted.
And does Russell do a full edit after you've done your work or how does it work? No?
I think he goes and reads things, which is probably a good thing for an editor to do. I know he's got a series of people that he thanks for his for proofreading and that sort of thing. But I don't actually know who his team is. I imagine Liz is definitely there, because that was how we sold the February Dragon to her. Was I had sent him The Girl with No Hands and suggested that the February Dragon would be one to go in there, and it was a collaboration with Lisa. And he came back saying, well, I don't think it's quite right for this collection, but Liz is just finishing editing for Scary Kisses and she really likes this. Would you mind if she bought that?
No, we don't mind at all.
Well, I was going to ask, actually, Tartarus, because that's the...
That's for sourdough.
Yes, sourdough.
How they differ with, Ticonderoga, completely different or very similar? Because also small press, boutique is a good word. I like that.
Boutique is a good word. Look, they were great to deal with as well, and really fast turnaround and lovely attention to detail. In a lot of ways, dealing with the small presses is really, really nice, because you get a lot of control and there's not that imperative to make sales or, that there are with big...
you want to make sales.
No, I know. But it's very nice the way we should just give the books to everyone.
Compared to, a traditional trade paperback, that your book may not even... You may have an editor who's championing the book, but if it doesn't get through a sales and marketing meeting, if it doesn't get through the acquisitions meeting, then it's down the toilet. One of the imperatives there is, do we think we can make money with this book? Yeah. So a small press thinks, we can sell this, but we actually like it. And we love it.
They're not trying to make it the next Harry Potter,
that sort of thing. So, yeah.
I have to say, the hardcover edition of Sourdough is an extraordinarily beautiful book.
It is
so lovely as an
the embossed it is cover. Just, it's
do you know, I didn't know there was an I got my book in the mail and I opened it and I went, oh, this is lovely, lovely dust. Oh, look at the creamy pages. It's just beautiful thing. And then I think I saw, it must have been on Angela's Facebook page or your blog or something, you had the picture of the book without the dust jacket. I'm looking at it going, oh, she got a really pretty edition.
It's the author edition.
What is that edition? And then and it clicked that that was a book without the dust jacket. It was like, it's like opening a Christmas present.
Yes. I always look under the dust jacket as soon as I get a hardcover to see what font they've used.
I do now. Like. Yeah. It's like what
you never know what prizes might put on there. Yeah.
$50 notes might fall out. That's it.
So, well, if you're like me, I use stupid things for bookmarks. So
yeah, maybe.
Not so much a $50 note, but I have lost prescriptions because I was putting them in a book as a bookmark. So.
Notes. Yeah. Yeah.
All sorts.
Now, Lisa, you won 2 Aurealis Awards. That's the rumours I hear. Yes. I believe it's a bit of a secret. It's not really. for Bluegrass Symphony, I actually, controversially, think you won an Aurealis Award for not the best short story in that book. There you go. I've said it.
How is that controversial?
Well, it is controversial because
I think you have a very strange definition of what controversy is.
Well, isn't because I'm going against what the judges said.
How is that controversial? There's a whole bunch of people who probably don't agree what the judges.
Weren't you one of them?
Yes. Oh wow! Someone doesn't agree with what the judges.
No, but I think
flame
that has never happened before.
I think the
Mr. Pickwick County.
That one is a corker and should have been on the list. There you go. You're wrong, Kirsten. You've got a chance to respond. Or Lisa can respond for you. No, I'm sorry. No, really. I think that's how good the bloody collection was.
Thank you.
That I actually don't think the best story won, but but you deserved an award. That's what I'm trying to say. Is that patronising?
Thank you.
It's not controversial.
Today, tonight, aren't going to do a feature on it.
No.
Which is actually
the
fine.
The podcast that went wrong.
Did you like your dinner tonight? Was that controversial? You didn't like your dinner?
Controversy. The podcast that's stealing Aussie jobs. Yes.
I think they had that tonight. Oh, that's genius. Anyway, back to the question. It was a statement.
The question was just, I am creating controversy. Respond.
I think it's an excellent collection. So,
thank you.
Yes.
Well, and I can't really comment on the awards because it's, you know, thank you.
We did review it, so.
Yeah.
We did too.
Yes, we did. Yes.
Have you listened to that yet, by the way? You haven't, have you?
No, I haven't. Because. but I did. So it's almost as though she's listening.
Yes, okay.
Listen to it to make sure that you guys didn't say anything horrible. And then I heard that you said wonderful things and then I felt satisfied. So I didn't have to listen to it. Because can you imagine listening to someone talk about your book for a half hour? That would be agonizing.
No. Absolutely not.
I could not. I could not.
Even if
not
you're
listen.
Saying lovely things, it's like, oh my God. I don't know. I have it. It's on my iPod.
Lisa is blushing.
You are.
This is radio. You're not supposed to tell her that.
Well, imagine her listening to the podcast.
I know.
I'm picturing
a spontaneous combustion event of some kind.
You'd be able to read by the glow.
I knew this would happen. I had visions of you blushing on this podcast.
We shall call it Blushcast from now on.
Oh, that's nice.
Next question.
Well, you both got Google alerts. Come on. I mean, you know when people are mentioning your stuff. It's the same deal.
Do you know what I get from Google alerts? All of the bluegrass concerts in the United States.
Oh, really?
Yes. Which is actually cool because they say some really weird sounding band names. So I tuck those away for later. But the rest, it's like every night at 10 o'clock, I get this ping and it's next at the Opera House. We're going to have some banjo music.
Symphony of Bluegrass.
Yeah, so I think Google alerts doesn't really work for me.
Angela, Google alerts?
Oftentimes it just tells me what I've put up on my own website.
Yeah, me too.
Terribly handy when you're as short. Your memory's as short as mine. Did I really do that?
Oh, yeah.
It's always like a day or two late too sometimes.
Yes, yes.
So sometimes you just pop in there and you think, oh, someone said something about me.
Oh,
it's me.
It's me.
And it actually wasn't even about me.
Now, you post quite a lot, Angela.
I try to be quite active with it, but because I've been away for five weeks, there's been a
small
hiatus.
Hiatus, good word.
But usually
I have a thesaurus. But usually I do try to, and I try to make it useful as well as amusing and occasionally shiny and useless, but sometimes of amusement to no one but myself.
I think we should link to both. You've got a blog, because I don't actually read your blog, Lisa. I should admit that sort of thing.
I generally do that in the show notes, Ian.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. We were saying last night how I stopped writing
them.
Yeah.
You wrote one.
Sorry, not last night. We were saying last month.
Two months ago. Yeah. 1 month ago.
It's 1 month
whenever.
Ago.
These are out of order.
Yes.
It's the magic of the future.
I'm sorry I don't read yours, Lisa.
Well, you really should, because the Tuesday therapy is...
No, but you linked to it anyway, so why would I bother RS putting
it... Angela only links to it.
Yeah. Wait, so then you have to click all the way through to my website.
And I think we need to point out that we're not actually the same person.
No, there are two of us.
There are two of us. There are twin beds. There's one body on each bed. There are two of us.
If anyone thinks you are the same person, it's only because the two of you have created that bloody perception.
Brian.
Yes, Brian. Exactly.
Well, now, I don't know. I'm
not the first.
Yeah. She's the Australian.
I'm not the first one to call you Brian. I'm not, am I? Others have.
You are the first.
No, actually, you are the first and only. Although Charles Tan, the bibliophile stalker, finds it absolutely hilarious and still giggles about it.
About what?
Brian.
Mondi thinking we were called Brian.
I'm not the first. Others did it. Certain.
Who would those others possibly be?
I don't know. Should we do the books or should we keep that on the question? Where are we at?
You've just got absolute fear that the three of us are going to turn on you and start picking at you. Then you'll take away your wife's brownies.
But seriously, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No.
Oh.
There we go.
What's coming out after Moonshine and What's Its Face?
Oh, let them get this book out first.
No.
Yeah.
Because they're writers, they've not even finished it yet. They're writers, so they're not thinking about future projects. They're just concentrating on the one project. Sorry.
You done?
Yes.
Okay.
Is there anything coming out after?
Well, I was lucky enough to get an arts essay project grant. So I've been working on my first novel, which is called The Familiar. And because we're working on Midnight and Moonshine at the same time, we've got the two projects on the go. I'm probably about, I don't know, this far into the book. So Midnight and Moonshine, and hopefully I'll have The Familiar done by the end of the year.
Is that familiar as in...
Which familiar?
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Except in hopefully a different way. Excellent. As usual. Lisa doing weird different things.
And you, Ms. Slater?
I'm turning the Brisneyland by Night short story into a novel.
Ah, yes, yes.
And
yes,
plotting a sequel called Vigil. We have a slow-moving future project, which is a mosaic novel, again, written together, set in the Sephiroth world that the February Dragon was set in. So
an actual novel this time, not a bunch of short stories.
No, a bunch of connected stories.
Oh, okay, the same concept. Okay.
Yeah. Because it's fun. We like
it
doing
it.
It is
fun.
And we both really like that mosaic structure. So that will be probably...
One thing I do want to bring up,
you, Angela, unlike you, Lisa, because you're not the same person,
no.
You actually don't, you've gone back to, you're full-time writing now, aren't you? You're not, or am I missed something?
I am full-time writing this year. My partner very kindly said take a year to finish the novels and consolidate the successes you've had, which was really good because... Last year, I think I only wrote 4 short stories, and that was because they were commissioned. And the rest of the time, I was finishing the damned PhD. So it's been really good having this year.
So he's allowed you to eat more than 2-minute noodles.
He has. But I'm basically a housewife. I stay at home and I do the dishes and the washing and the cooking, and I have absolutely no problem with that because in between times.
You have the 2 o'clock nap, don't you?
I fully have a 2 o'clock nap, but I also get to write, and it is a very nice setup. And it's, you know, we're both really
happy.
Are you
going to do the same thing, Lisa?
Well, I have been since January, but just because of the grant, because I had the money to buy me out of teaching for a semester. But not so yay. I have just put in my application for next semester. So, yeah, they bought me a semester off, which was great. So full time. So that's why I could do novel and the collection at the same time.
Okay. All right, now we'll go to the books. Yeah. I just was interested to know.
You do wonderful segues.
They're some of the smoothest.
Very clear. We are going to talk about the books now. Yeah. Here's my newscaster voice. Everyone, we are talking about the books.
My segues are like a single malt whiskey from the Highlands of Scotland.
Yucky.
So,
I hate Scotch.
And
well,
gross.
That's your problem.
Disgusting.
No, it's beautiful.
Stinky and yuck.
It's flavoured with port. It's really nice. Not that I drink much whiskey. So...
Okay.
Well, it's your job. Come on.
Stop it.
Fear cracker.
Just,
whip.
Hey.
What?
Don't make me get a whip. All right.
It's going to be all belting up.
So Monday. Shut up. I had enough of you. Might do this on my own from now on. I've got friends. All right. We're going to start with the book that Angela recommended, which was Voice of the Fire by Alan Moore. And not to put you on the spot, Angela, but can you tell us a little bit about the book and why you recommended it?
Well, essentially it was one of the books I studied for my PhD and I saw no reason why I should suffer alone. No, that's
oh, God.
That is... actually not fair. I think it is a brilliant book. But I think the big stumbling block with it is the first story, which is written in quite a strange dialect, which makes it very dense and very hard to get through. And I think a lot of readers probably just went, fuck this. I could be washing my hair, rather than go on to the second story, which is sort of the tale of a psychotic girl trying to...
I really like the second story.
It's amazing. Mm. It is amazing. The cremation fields.
Yes.
You know, just her trying to weasel her way through life and committing all these quite awful acts with no thought for consequence and then just terrible, terrible consequences at the end. But yeah. She's a very compelling... Because it's all the stories in it are first person.
Yeah.
And she is a very compelling narrator. And I actually find pretty much all of the stories apart from the first one just quite an incredible exercise in voice.
Yeah.
Mm. Not so much.
Well, see, I agree with you on the
think just before you start, you know, I'll just as an overview, just for anyone who's not read the book, because I'd imagine there might be quite a few people. We give spoilers on this podcast, and I know there is a lot of people who go, "Oh, I won't listen to that one yet because I want to read the book." But I imagine there's a lot of people who go, "Alan Moore, yeah, I'll listen to that." So, just to give an overview for people who haven't read the book, it's set in Northampton, which is his birthplace, and where he's lived for his whole life. And it is, the first story is set in 4000 BC, and then there's a bit of a jump up to
about 2500
AD or something like that.
I thought there were two.
Yeah, there are two in BC.
But it's thousands of years.
A couple of thousand.
It's basically 12 stories over a 6000.
And they're all
period.
They're all in the what will become Northampton.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. And they're all self-contained stories, but as is the way with mosaic novels, there's little
threads and motifs.
Yeah,
go through them mostly in dreams and in references to various motifs that pop up.
Magic and fire particularly fire, always, yeah. You know, weaves in.
And also
in
just
some
ideas. Asides where they mention a character.
Yes. A lot of characters have – there's a lot of dreams where a character in a story is going to have a dream.
With the character from a previous
from
story.
From a previous story.
Ghosts and that sort of thing.
So that's
for no good reason.
Because it's a mosaic novel.
Oh, yeah, but – yeah,
so you're bitterly resenting me for this.
Yeah, I did say WTF, Angela, quite a few times. What shat me
I'm gonna confess we might be both bitterly resenting. Yes.
I think I have to – I feel so bad. I
thought that might be the case.
I was reading it going – Angela gave this 5 stars on Goodreads, and I'm finding this such a chore. This isn't.
Yeah.
Can I just say, that fucking entrance exam at the front of the book is, and that's what it is. I'm certain that's what Moore's done. Because you see, and we were talking about this in the car, yeah. we did break our rule and we had to speak. We did. We thought we had to get a bit of the bile out before we got to the podcast, to be honest.
Drain the bile. It's not the shunt out.
It's not like Moore decided to write in a Chaucer-like style for that period. Well, you know, to write in the period of the year that he's talking about. It's only this first story where he, and the one towards the end where he does no grammar, where he goes all fucked up and thinks he's being, and it feels like an entrance exam. It feels like, I'm Alan Moore. This is one of the greatest pieces of art ever written, but I want you to fucking, I'm not going to put this in the middle of the book and let you lead up to it. I'm going to put it at the start.
Yes.
If you can't get through it, it means you don't deserve to read my fucking art. Fuck off. It's what it felt like.
And as I said to Ian.
That is pretty much Alan Moore's personality.
But I mean, well, as I said to Ian, though, I said, but okay, if this is an entrance exam, I'm not fucking taking it.
Yeah.
And it's not, I'm not going to fail it. I just think it's pointless. I'm going to refuse to sit the test.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people have done it, like Ridley Walker.
But Ridley Walker was a degeneration of language.
Yeah.
And I found
it was the kind of thing where you read a few pages and you're thinking, what the?
I really
but
like
then
Ridley
your
Walker.
Mind switches into it and it's fine. And I didn't feel that with this first story at all.
Because with Ridley Walker and Clockwork Orange, as Ian brought up, there's It is using language that we know as a starting point. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons for this linguistic drift in both of those books.
Yep.
The way Alan Moore has written the first one is just completely arbitrary. I mean, that character wouldn't be speaking English for a start.
No,
yeah.
So every single word he's put down, he has arbitrarily chosen to translate as this English word. Mm. So he could have chosen any word.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
he could have chosen any grammar style.
Yeah.
And it seems very, well, it is arbitrary and it seems, yeah, as Ian said, kind of I'm going to make you work to read my book. Yeah. It's like, no.
It does seem, and not just in this first story, but there were a couple of instances because a couple of the stories in the book, I thought, wow, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Like the one with the head on the wall.
Oh, I love that one.
And
I do.
Things, there were a couple of instances where I thought, with that word choice, it's so obvious that he is consciously picking words and, you know, trying to make it very self-aware. But then there were some instances where it shat me that they stood, like in that cremation one, there was the description of the little baby girl, the unborn fetus in a jar, and
he's
set in this tent with all the shamanistic stuff around it, and there's this unborn baby in a jar, and he says, and her face was painted white and colored like a whore, and I went, really?
I think I highlighted that one,
and I just thought, okay, 2500 BC. Sure, you might have the concept of whore, but this is in the middle of nowhere, Northampton.
It's a word choice.
It is the second oldest profession in the world.
Well, yes, true. But with these particular people in this tiny thing where they're obviously having sex in other ways and there doesn't seem to be any commerce that revolves around
and even if it's not commerce, it's that particular word has connotations, which are not positive.
And it was jarring to have it attributed to a baby, but that wasn't the thing that bothered me. It just seemed that he's so aware of the period in which he's trying to write that I thought, would somebody in that period have used the word whore? I don't think
there's a lot
fit.
Of word choices that are out of they're anachronistic. There are a lot of anachronistic.
What about the use of the word will all the way through? For penis. Will is that, was that the original? Because I don't know enough. I'm stupid.
Shakespeare did a lot of punning on will. The will sonnets.
Okay.
But also, you know, there's the story with the limping to Jerusalem, and he uses the word pandemonium, which...
Which story is that one?
That's the one where he's in the Crusades, and he goes, and
hated that.
But so I was resenting this story.
Is that the Templar one?
The Templar.
Oh, okay, I actually love that one. Yeah. That's one of my favourites in there. Lord Simon's such a repellent character.
He is.
But he's also this man whose faith is utterly, utterly broken.
Over a scrunched up head that he thinks is Jesus.
He thinks is Jesus.
But there's no indication. Okay, whatever. No. Yeah.
But it's also about the weakness and the irrationality of faith.
Yeah, look.
And
look,
religion
look,
in
let's,
general.
Let's be straight here. I actually, once you do get past the entrance exam, I love the second story.
Yeah.
I love the Roman guy with the head, with the finding the coins, because that also is about faith.
Yeah, head of Diocletian.
I love that one. The bird guy and the missing village, I didn't see the point
to. I liked that one.
I liked that one too, because of the ending.
Yeah. The
end. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's just the bird guy then keeps popping up everywhere. And
oh, he's in another, I think, he maybe referenced twice.
Yeah.
I say that like that's a terrible thing. But anyway, I wasn't sure about the nun one. It felt a bit flagellating because she gets flagellated.
That could just be Catholicism in general.
Yeah, no, but that was a really odd one because that's the first time where, I mean, she grows legs suddenly.
No, they are usable. She's able to.
Yeah, she had legs. She just had a miraculous cure.
I missed that bit. And yeah, you're right. And
it's
and
easy to miss words in Alan Moore's writing.
And weird Cthulhu stuff comes out of a crypt, which isn't properly explained. And
yes.
I was actually hoping, Angela, that you could explain some of the stuff to me because obviously I failed the entrance exam. I got the crying game story, but the first one because
yes, Hobbs Hawk. Yeah. Yeah,
but I wonder when crying game came out.
That would be
why are you actually answering this seriously?
Because you looked at me and
it did seem like a serious question.
Yeah. It probably was, I suppose.
This probably was an invention of Alan Moore's imagination, though.
Yeah.
Okay, but I was constantly. I knew I was missing the point. I got the Templar one. Mm. I knew without him saying Templar, I knew that was.
Yeah.
That was about, and I felt proud of myself, which is probably why I enjoyed that story more than you did, because I thought, oh, I won that. Hey! 10 out of 10 for me. But, yeah, I know I was missing allusions and stuff like that. And, again, I think it's because of, as I've said in some other books, my cultural background is not Celtic, Anglo-Saxon. You know, there aren't too many Jews in the book. I mean, there are, but they're usually just fodder for other characters.
For Christians, yes.
Or just mentioned on the city limits.
Yeah. Unlike Galore, which has also got a lot of biblical allusions, but those were, well, A, they were obvious, and B, they come back to Old Testament stuff, which obviously I'm very familiar with. Yeah. So, I'm hoping you can explain it to me, Angela. I don't know what exactly.
What in particular?
The whole book.
Like universe and everything.
Well,
42. I mean, the things that I – obviously Hobbs Hog was very difficult and I really did not like it. And when I teach creative writing, I actually use that as an example of how not – to write dialect and in fact why writing in dialect unless you're very, very good isn't a good idea because it's too easy to make the journey for your reader to your story and to meaning too difficult.
Yeah.
Because if a person can't be bothered to get through your story because of the language, then you've failed as a writer. Because I do think it's about communicating.
But you know that's not what he's thinking. And some of the people that you were quoting to me, the reviews, were saying, oh, no, it's the failure of the reader. Because this is genius, that first chapter.
No.
You know, there's a whole forum devoted to analysing that first chapter.
Yeah, and just saying that he's Alan Moore, therefore everything he does is genius. Look at this piece of toilet paper. Because I think even geniuses have prentice work, you know, and they're not right every time.
I think the problem with the first, I'll say story, because it doesn't really feel like chapters, but is that it's a 50-plus page thing that I think sets some really important motifs for the rest of the book. Mm. But you get one and then you have to wade through 20 pages to get to the other. And I was thinking that it would be an excellent introduction, even with the dialect, if it was about 10 pages long instead of 50. Mm. Because you get, you know, there's some things where you just think, okay, really, the story is about a young boy who gets cast off from his society. His mother dies. She gets buried. Okay, the symbol of her foot sticking up appears over and over throughout. So you need to have that. Okay, he goes wandering across the fens or whatever it would have been 4,000, 6,000 years ago.
Yes.
Sees a couple of other roundhouses. Roundhouses are going to be an image. That appear later. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Then he goes and finds Hob and his helper.
Yes.
And he stays in a little shack outside of their house. And that little shack motif appears. All right, hooray. So we have wandering. We have a young kid. Exile, all these things that are important, but you do not need to take 50 plus pages to say that simple, simple, simple story where he's meandering into a whole bunch of other shit in between that you kind of go, at this stage, I don't know what a shag foal is and I don't fucking care. So move on. Or at least that's how I felt.
Shag foal's going to get you.
Yeah, I know.
Is this a big furry dog?
Dog? You get that by black the end, but in the first story, you have this kid who's obviously impaired and they bring up the kind of half.
No, wait. Why do you say, Neil Gaiman says that in the introduction as well. Sorry, where does it say he's impaired?
It doesn't say, but it's because of the simplistic way he reacts to things. So when people, like her lying, you know, telling
he doesn't
what,
understand
he doesn't even
that she's
know
dead.
What a lie is.
Okay.
He doesn't know his mum is dead. He doesn't really...
Yeah. And his thoughts and his way of understanding the world read like he is a child of maybe 3 or 4. And then evidently, as the story progresses, he's very much not a child of 3 or 4. Therefore, he must have the mental capability of a much younger...
Okay, it wasn't obvious to me, but again...
Becomes more obvious in retrospect as well, because he keeps bringing back in a half-wit kind of character in many of the other stories. So you think, then at the end, they're not always boys, but they're half-wits. And then at one of the last stories, they talk about a half-wit boy that's, you know, lost his mother and been exiled from the group. So it's this kind of repetitive imagery again. So you think, okay, definitely that kid in the first story was... somehow.
And the transgender stuff at the end of that story, I mean, does that, because I don't remember that motifing, other than the fact of the idea of transformation, which is in a lot of the other stories.
I don't think that transgender stuff appears in the other stories, but the kind of, I'm trying to shock you with unusual erotic behavior, first off, is what he then
so wrong.
Picks up and takes.
That is
and
the oddest, I mean, the fact that it's written in the way it is, that is the oddest blowjob wanker guy I've seen, I'm never going to read. And the amount of sperm he that is described in great detail. It is funny. I did laugh when the young boy notices how far his sperm got. Like it's hit a flower.
It's
like
hanging off a flower.
Yeah, it's hanging off a flower. That actually, I laughed at that. I thought, Alan, I got that one. Yeah. The rest of us all fucking gibberish.
But
that
one's for you. But the whole thing.
Universal yardstick.
It feels like all of that imagery, it's like we get it. You don't need to take that long to tell us. Like you know, you have to be a kind of, I think that he sets up all these stories as stories that you have to read critically and closely and slowly.
They're not taught at university possibly. Even.
Well, they're not there to have you get swept up in the story and enjoy it. So in that case, it seems like he's then going, look at what I'm doing here. Look at what I'm doing here a lot in that first story. So that you're kind of like, okay, I get it. Now, can you condense that? And then I can notice those things myself. Like that's something that reading the last story, which is him inserting himself into the story, I was actually really annoyed because I thought, you've just set all these difficult stories for your readers. Mm. You trust that they've actually made it through the book with you, and now you're going to explain everything to them, which is really annoying.
I don't think he does trust the reader. I think the whole book is actually kind of Alan Moore's joke at the reader's expense.
Yeah.
That's exactly what Angela thought when she recommended it.
No, not really.
It's because, I mean, it starts off with that first story that we've discussed at length now, which immediately puts you offside. And it goes through all these other stories, some of which I really did like, some of which I found either problematic or just a bit tedious. But then it ends with this story. Which he says in that story is the only logical place it could have ended, and really, no. Alan,
no. Because it's a fiction, but not a lie.
Yes. Oh, fuck, that annoyed
me.
Yes.
This must be a documentary.
Yeah.
But, and then, as Lisa says, he then goes on to explain everything he's done, because you as the reader couldn't possibly understand the genius of Alan Moore, so I will explain it to you. And it's, I don't think that it's a book that he's written for anyone other than himself, and not in a good way. I know every writer writes for themselves.
Kirsten gave me a warning of the last chapter before I read it, and I thought it was going to be
I just said you had to read it.
Yeah,
I said because Ian, did you end up reading the whole book?
I didn't totally finish it. I didn't. I read 80% of it.
Yeah, because Ian said to me last night,
I'm
running out of time. And I said, well, okay, skip. Like, you have to read the last story. Yeah. Anything else you can read, fine, but you must read the last one.
Mm-hmm. So I read it, but before reading it, I thought he was going to do, considering the style of the book, I thought that we'd get all James Joyce and he'd do the sort of Molly Bloom orgasm soliloquy thing at the end. That's what I thought it was going to be.
Remember that semen on the flower, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, that's right.
There's no teeth is coming back.
Actually, quite a bit of semen. There's a lot of semen, there's a lot of cockage, a lot of pubic hair.
It's Alan Moore.
It's
that's
throughout the whole fucking book. I thought, well, why not? Just go Alan Moore wanking off in one big soliloquy.
That's what he's been doing.
At the very end.
The whole chapter is Alan Moore wanking off.
With Alan Moore jerking off and there's threads of semen across. Because the way she said it, I thought it was going to be like threads of semen spattered across his room. And it's not that. It's actually worse, in my opinion.
I meant the last chapter was Alan Moore literally waking up.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But to hark back to that James Joycean soliloquy. Yeah.
I find that last story difficult because it breaks the frame. He spent a lot of time building up a world that is immersive, and you know, even though some of these stories are flawed, which I've never doubted, that just for me shattered it, and I really didn't like it. I did not like seeing the writer put in there, particularly because one of the favourite stories in here for me is I Travel in Suspenders, which is about the murderer A.A. Rouse.
I like that story a lot.
Based on a true story.
Yeah,
he was one of the few guys who, you know, who one of the first insurance fraud murders.
Yeah,
and for me, I just think the voice in it is so amazing.
Yeah,
and just this portrait of a sociopath who's terribly, terribly charming.
Yes,
and the really
in a repulsive
out,
kind of way.
In a truly repulsive way. But you can see why he would charm some people. And he starts off with all the lies, but as it goes through this terrible unravelling, and you start to get this quite nervous feeling about who it is. And if you didn't know who A.A. Rouse was, then you'd still have a certain sense to that. And I just think that is such an amazing triumph of voice, and then he fucks it up.
Yes,
with this self-indulgent. I think the writer.
The theme for me of the whole book is there are some really. I think why I feel particularly annoyed with it is that there are some excellent, beautiful parts and some cool ideas and some really engaging, interesting ideas that I want to. You know, want to spend more time picking it apart. But at the same time, I don't, because the whole thing then just goes off into that other.
Yeah. It's really presumptuous too, because he's, I mean, this is in essence, I mean, the very early stories you can't pin down to a historical character, but they're a stand-in for an historical character. So the whole book is most of the stories are based on historical figures.
So there was a true Solomon thingy you built around Church in Northampton. I could have checked this on Google
if I could have checked it myself.
No, I believe there is.
Yeah, I believe he was probably the one who.
And of course, there was Guy Fawkes and that guy on the pole. Yeah, so
and the poet and So we get to the end of this, and you've. I mean, it's really presumptuous because you've got Alan Moore sticking himself in there as the only logical choice.
Yes,
in his own words. To end the book. And it's like, really?
Well, and he tries to couch it in, it's only fair that the city is the last character, but it's actually not at all.
It's you.
Yeah.
The city becomes very nice.
Because he could have easily written the city as last character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And told you a story about the city as it is now without including himself in it. It's not about Northampton. It's about Alan Moore.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that I think kind of... I meant to say spoils, and I was about to say soils. And actually, now I think soils is even better.
That's very Freudian.
That's a really good Freudian slip. In the last, what kind of soils the rest of the book is the romanticism in the last, the romanticism of the past in the last chapter. This idea that. I highlighted.
Is that when
he
says how Church is getting up there?
Yeah, I'm just going to read it. It's everything grand we had, we tore to bits. Our castles, our emporiums, our witches and our glorious poets. Smash it up, set fire to it and stick it in the fucking madhouse. And it's sort of this, this romanticism of the past when he hasn't spent a great deal of time with the previous stories.
He hasn't shown a romantic past.
No, he hasn't. And so if that's his idea of... what we should still have.
Unless he's trying to do that in a kind of ironic way, because he hasn't. All of the
Except
stories
that I don't
are
know, because the whole last story is about how we should like what we have now is empty and vapid, and we don't care about stuff anymore, like castles and witches.
It's you're right, because it is. He's in that last story. Yeah. He's also trying to unpeel as much history as he can out of Northampton and shove it down your throat.
Yeah.
So, in other words, all the other chapters he didn't get to write, he's distilled
down.
He's
shoving it all in here.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me that in that last chapter, it wasn't a pretty picture that he was painting. The whole thing, even though it was him and he was talking about his, it seemed to me that all of the stories, apart from maybe the first one, and I just didn't notice because it was too long, but all of them go through the same sort of pattern where it's like, we introduce this character in a predicament. They go on for a couple of pages and then have a flashback. And then after the flashback happens for a couple of pages, then they're going to go on in their current story. And then they'll have a dream. And then they'll go in the current
About
story.
The stick man.
And then they'll flashback. But it becomes this kind of rhythm that I think he's actually... I think he's doing intentionally. And so it kind of seems like if he's done that for however many stories in a row, that he's so aware of this rhythm of, I'm going to do the same thing. And all of the stories turn out where the people end up dying or something shitty happens or whatever.
Yeah.
Then to get to this other last story with him in it. And it's kind of like a love song to this city that actually seems like shit. Like, I'm sorry to people that live in Northampton, but the way he describes it in this last chapter, I go, it's full of gangs and, you know, you need to have... He doesn't paint a very lovely picture. So I wonder if he's being ironic and he's kind of like, I'm going to talk about this glorious stuff in the past, but if you've actually read the rest of my book, I haven't glorified it there.
The Northampton
But he throws his girlfriend
board.
In there as well. I didn't get the reason for having his girlfriend in there. And the rude things he says to his girlfriend's cat. And you know what the best bit of that last chapter is? When his brother asks him in the pub, what's your story about?
And he went, oh.
And he, but he has this long paragraph about it. It's about this, it's about that. Because, again, he's telling you exactly what he's fucking books about.
The deconstruction of his own book.
But
the
answer he gives his brother sums it up. Oh, I don't know yet. Yeah, you're right, Alan. That's spot on. Good work.
But again,
sorry,
but
Angela.
And I stand by the reasons I gave it a 5 because it was a challenging read. It had a broad store of knowledge required to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I found it quite illuminating. I loved the craft in it. The you know things like the voice and setting of scenes, Hobbs Hog notwithstanding, things like the angel language where the wife and mother of a killer or a guy in prison conspire to kill the judge because that
I was so happy when that judge got killed.
He was the worst judge in the world. But I loved that there's this tension still between mother-in-law and daughter, which is very subtle and beautifully put in there.
But the rest of that scene with the three of them and
that's
with the little
excellent.
Girl
but
too.
But the rest of the story I found just so turgid because it was so obvious what was going to happen.
Yeah.
As soon as he said, I'm a sex maniac, okay, and I have power, so this girl's going to love me. I thought, that girl and her daughter are going to play you and you're going to die at the end.
And they're probably witches.
So I was just there.
Because that's a theme.
Going, obviously you're trying to make it seem like, oh, he's going to have this love affair and, oh, he's just so self-confident. The whole time we are sitting here going, we know it's going to happen and this is boring. So just get to the part where he dies, please.
Yeah. Dog, oh, sorry. Sorry.
No, no, please.
But there's a lot of craft in this book.
that's something that I really
do admire. And I remember reading it for PhD for a particular, you know, kind of thing and how it all fitted together.
Yeah. But that's why it's frustrating too, because you can see
there is
so much brilliant
stuff.
And there's so much thought and all of the stuff you just said is why it's so frustrating. Wank. Because, it doesn't. It's not a successful whole, and that's what it's really trying hard to be. But there are these brilliant things like you can see that he's agonized over words and has made up new words that, you know, I really enjoyed his attention to language, but...
Except it's not really, because it's not consistent with the periods he was writing for, except for potentially that first one where, as you've said, it's arbitrary.
It's not consistent.
He didn't... If he was going to follow through with what he did in that first chapter, I would have hated it, but he should have tried to go back to the dialect of the period and to muck around, but he just goes back into a sort of twee Tolkien-esque sort of
fake
reconstruction medieval of type of language.
Ye olde
18th, 16th, but I think if he
tried to do that, then it would have been even more dense. And,
oh, I agree.
And but, you couldn't have read any part of it.
No, I disagree, because if you read, I mean, he's not. If you read a lot of the works of previous centuries, then it's not as though they're all incredibly dense and hard to understand. I mean, once you get out of Old and Middle English, the variety in language is huge. So he didn't have to pick really dense styles. I mean, he just didn't have to.
I think the other thing is that I found that the rhythm...
he's done it anyway.
The rhythm of all of his sentences, and that was one of the things that I found, that's why I say it felt boring, was because in the head story, the one that we've all said that we liked, he varied his sentences, he varied the rhythm, so yeah. It was a more engaging, interesting, but in a lot of the
and
other
ones...
And
in the suspender story too.
Yeah, in a lot of the other stories, the sentences have exact... It's like you could practically see him counting the beats on his fingers to make sure that each sentence, like, you know when you do iambic pentameter, I need to make sure all of my sentences go okay, next sentence. So by the time you get to the end of a page really densely written with the exact same rhythm, no matter how beautiful some of those words are, your mind is starting to get lulled into a sleepy, and maybe he's trying to make it hallucinatory and like dream, like, I don't know, but it actually made me fall asleep once.
It made me.
I like that story.
It made me skim read more than once, like skim read to just get what was happening in the story.
I would say that I never did. I haven't finished it. I didn't get to four stories, so I read seven plus the last. I've read 8 out of 12 stories, but I never skim read. I fucking worked through that 50 pages of the first chapter. I never thought, oh, fuck this. I really wanted to feel like I'd done something in my life.
I think the one that made me sleepy was The Sun Looks Pale Upon the Wall about the poet John Clare.
Oh, I really liked that one.
No, I really hated it. That bored me.
Is that the one? Because I might have started that
one. See, we're not the same person.
Is that the one where it starts that he's really horny?
Which, what?
No.
You'll have to be more specific.
No, the poet,
yeah,
he ends up in
it's
an,
the poet. The one I started that I didn't finish.
No, I think that's the judge one.
I think that's the judge one.
Where he thinks about girls all the time.
Yes, that's the judge one. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right, gotcha.
See, that's a story about a really repulsive person, and I like that story. I thought the Templar story, I think because it was all one note for me, that story.
He was an angry old man.
Yeah, so it was very,
very
much
definitely
one note.
An angry old man with a turgid little penis.
Yes, a turgid little penis and a penchant for spanking his missus.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know. I think there are three or four stories in there which I really, really liked. But I really don't think it succeeds as a work as a whole work. I don't think it does. I think it falls down far too many times, and it begins badly and ends badly.
Seriously, those last five paragraphs, that incantation shit. Mm. What the fuck was that?
Well, he's a magician, he was. I don't know what he's now. But at this point, I think he just...
But what is that?
Like Crowley magic.
Oh, okay, fine.
But that's what it is. That's what it is.
And I enjoy cricket. But, you know, I mean... But what's it... But what?
But that's because the last chapter is about Alan Moore and what is important to Alan Moore. That's the last chapter. Okay.
And it also really needed to have some Hayley Jones in there, you know, just...
have we... I'm sorry, Angela.
We do this sometimes.
Why?
Well,
we shred books.
You've explained why you gave it 5 stars.
Yeah, but I don't expect everyone to go, that was brilliant.
Yeah. We loved it. What an interesting podcast.
Yes. That would be, and they all had lemonade.
I think if I hadn't been reading this book on my very expensive tablet, it might have gotten thrown across the room. Several points.
Well, that's actually what I did with 100 Years of Solitude after getting to the end of that, which is interesting. And that might be a nice segue into Crummies Galore, because there's an interesting, similar feel to the end there. But
well, I felt
you're
like
in charge of the podcast.
I thought that there were similarities, despite the fact that I really didn't take to a lot of Voice of the Fire, that it was really interesting that we picked these two books because they both talk about memory and history and those kind of cyclical things. Yeah,
and generational. Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Seriously, then the car generation. It's not generational.
I said it's not generational.
It's 6,000 years. Okay, it's not the same fucking characters.
It's the story of a longitude-latitude point.
Northampton goes through generational period. It's the character.
I don't know. I think Crummies is generational. Not so much Alan Moore.
Ian's wrong again. So
have another chocolate brownie.
Yeah, I've got mine actually. Lisa, I was going to call you Michael Crummy. So Michael Crummy, why did you pick Lisa's book galore?
Well, okay, so I picked this book because I read it when it came out in Canada. I did my PhD on Icelandic sagas, which is all about generational family stories. So
that's another connection, the PhD connection.
Oh yeah. We're the same person. So I picked this one up because I read the blurb, and I normally don't read blurbs because I don't like to know what's going to happen in the book. I'd like to just read it without having that. So this one, though, I thought I need a book for the plane trip home to Australia. Read that and went, okay, it's supposed to be a generational saga of Newfoundland in Canada, couple hundred years with magical medievalish sort of setting. And I went, okay, that ticks all the boxes that I like.
My plane book.
Yeah, and so why I recommended it was because I just remember, I hadn't reread it at that time. I just remember loving the kind of quirky characters. I loved that all of the women were really strong, and I loved that all of the characters were flawed, whether physically or emotionally. And I just remember that it resonated really strongly with me. But as we were saying before, when you read on a plane, you don't always retain everything. So I kind of went, I remember loving it and getting to the end and just being sad that it was over. So I thought, after we saw him at Adelaide Writers Week, I thought, oh, yeah, I want to read that one again. So let's pick that.
I love this book.
Yay.
Sorry, again, because I genuinely loved I was bawling my eyes out in the last 10 pages.
Really?
Oh, fuck yeah. I was into this. And I know it's about 130 years of history.
Mm.
But, you know, to go back a step, what shat me with the people who gave it one star, because I don't know why I fucking read them, but I can't help
you
myself.
You didn't go on Goodreads, did you?
No, I went on Amazon.
Oh, and going, even worse.
You're saying there's too many characters and not everything ties up and there's all these disconnected stories and it doesn't make sense. That was a review of about 5 or 6 different people.
No, that's not a review. That's an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's true.
That's a whiny-ass opinion.
I possibly put a voice on there.
Most Amazon reviews are actually just opinions.
Okay.
No, I'm
all right, fine. I'm just saying, I realise I never should read one-star reviews of books that I love because that's a really stupid thing to do because this book just hit me hard in the gut in a good way. I don't necessarily want to go to Labrador or Newfoundland.
Yeah.
And I assume the gut and Tolts Road or whatever don't actually exist.
I don't.
He based, I heard him talking on a YouTube clip and he based Paradise Deep and the gut on
real places
but changed the names and altered things to fit the story, obviously. So, no, there is no actual places named that.
But he mined the oral history and talked to his parents and friends of his parents.
He did a load of research into the folklore of Newfoundland.
Yeah, and the part where Adelina, her warts are witched off, that was based on a friend's sister.
Yeah.
Really?
This is the story he told at Adelaide Writers Week that you know, when he was doing the research for it, and a friend of his said, oh, well, I should tell you about my sister, and that, you know, his sister was born with warts all over her, and, you know, got to 15 or 16 and, you know, quite in despair, and then the mother located a cunning woman and phoned her and basically said, oh, this woman said, okay, what's her name? And
how old is she?
She told her, and that was it.
Did it over the phone.
Did it over the phone, so there was no crossing palm with silver or anything like that.
Yeah, it was like, I'll just take care of it, don't worry about it.
Basically, and the next morning, the girl woke up and these had all fallen off, and it was like a filled mason jar or something like that.
A quarter jar of
these warts that had dropped off. And that makes it into the story because that's one of those irresistible things as a writer that you hear and you just go, stealing that.
See, I did wonder with The Shade, with Mr. Gallery.
Mr. Gallery's fantastic.
Yeah. Whether he took it too far when he falls through the ceiling.
No, and do you know why?
But he recovers it.
No, Ian.
That's my teacher voice. Yes.
Sit in the corner, Ian.
Now, why I got so excited there was because when he was in Adelaide, I was really curious to know if he had read any of the Icelandic sagas, because the ghosts are actually just people who have come back to life. So they're exactly like
corporeal.
Yeah. Yep. So it's more like a zombie, except they're not brainless. They are exactly the same person as they were in real life, except they happen to be dead, basically. So I thought this is so... The way he structured the story, the way the women are, the way that there are things like Mr. Gallery, I thought,
and you don't get the whole... You don't get the whole story often the first time.
Yeah.
Like the first time we have the priest who's stooping Mrs. Gallery. Yeah. And Mr. Gallery's there. I'm reading going,
You don't know that he's a ghost. Yeah.
He's right there in the lounge room.
But I think that...
And they're just whinging that he's making a bit of noise poking the fire. It's like, you're poking something else.
But
possibly he has cause for complaint.
I asked him about it in Adelaide because I said, did you read the sagas? Because to me, that exact kind of scene is exactly the dry, bizarre thing that would happen in the sagas. And he said, oh, I've read Greenland, the one that's set in Greenland, which has got lots of ghosts that do exactly that kind of thing. And so I wondered, like, he didn't say, yes, and I was inspired by Greenland's saga.
Yeah. And that's where I got Mr. Gallery from.
But I kind of went, okay, that makes sense. So him falling through the roof is actually something that Icelandic ghosts do. They sit there to cause trouble. They sit on the roof and start banging their heels and stuff, and so they fall through the roof. And so I thought it made perfect sense. And so when he was having sex with Mrs. Gallery, it was like, of course he's dead.
Yeah,
right away, but it does.
Oh, no, I didn't. I just went, well, that's a really forgiving answer.
Yeah. Then it becomes, but it does. He builds it so beautifully that it comes out
later.
I had
actually completely forgotten. Like when that story was picked up again and they're talking about the courtship between the woman who will become Mrs. Gallery.
Virtue,
that's it. And the courtship, and then that whole relationship, and then how it turns out. Until that point, I'd completely forgotten that they were the couple from the other part of the story. Mm. And it was like, oh, that's what happened.
That's what's bringing about.
Yes. And it's like, I don't feel so sorry for Mr. Gallery anymore.
It is funny. It is so bloody funny. Every two or three pages, I was genuinely laughing out loud to the annoyance of my wife. Because I read it in bed quite a bit. And yeah, it's just, I loved at the very beginning, and that's really what got me, the young, slightly retarded, possibly, boy, Woundy. Because they've got this Bible, Mr. Jabba's Trim's Bible, that doesn't do the whole, that doesn't do the Isaac story to the end, so they don't know whatever. does Abraham
make up their own ending?
He does. He makes up his own ending, and it's hilarious. You know, just really funny. And him rooting a mermaid, and it's just, it's really, 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 and an earnest funny. He's not doing it for, well, Crummy might be doing it for the laughs, but the way he tells the story, the characters aren't doing it for the laughs. It's very earnest in the way it's portrayed.
The humour of the book is very much a laughing with you type of humour. Mm-hmm. It's not a oh, look at these funny
backwards
people.
Well, because the people seem real. Like the stuff that they're doing that we find comical is funny because people do that kind of thing. And you have that, well, I'll make up my own ending. And when you say that's not the real ending, I'm not going to believe you because that ending is rubbish. You know, my ending is the right one.
So much better.
So it just, you can identify with that kind of... Mm. Human nature, I guess.
But I love that, you know, there's this kind of fragmentary nature to the story because so much of it is based in the oral history. And, like, you know, the big things across the world are covered in a few paragraphs. But then when it digs down and gives you the detail, it's all these lives, it's all these events.
How it ripples through.
And they're so astonishing. And I love that line. I think it might have been Callum Devine thinking how much he resents his mother and his wife because he feels like the women move everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that he's just on top of the wave. It's just astonishing. And things like James Woundy having, you know, making up his own stories from this incomplete Bible. It's that whole thing of oral history and the bits
and also
that I don't,
you don't
really
get
know
a specific date until you're about two thirds at least
well and truly
through.
Into it. I noticed
the whole first half of the book was kind of
is in that kind of ethereal,
untimed
kind of. And that I thought was really appealing because he does eventually give specific dates.
Because he brings in Coker or Croker, who's a real person.
With all the union stuff, you go, okay, this is happening here, and the 1800s. So then you start going, okay, so that stuff must have been happening, you know,
because you follow the generations
back. And I just loved that it did seem like an oral history. So I think the book covers
about a century?
It's a bit more
about
than that.
Two centuries.
Is it?
Okay. Some of the characters are really quite long-lived, so by the time the two generations pass, they're actually really old.
What the fuck are you all complaining about? Most of you have lived to 90 and well above. Come on.
But yeah, except the ones who starved to death in winter.
And all of the ones that got maimed and loses a leg and
fell into pots of boiling.
Except for them.
But then Bridie going and having her teeth taken out.
Taking out all of her teeth.
Just because one of them hurts. So let's just take them all out.
Let's get them out.
That's not so strange. I remember thinking
you remember when you had all your teeth.
No, I remember thinking when I was in my teens, it's like, right, what can we lose? We can lose the appendix, we can lose the kidneys. Let's just get rid of all this stuff that could cause trouble.
Good Lord.
Just get rid of it. We don't need any of it. It's gone. The breast's gone.
So you appreciate it, Bridie.
Absolutely. I think she's a very practical young woman. She didn't know she was going to end up marrying the guy who could have seen her teeth for the rest of her life.
Yes.
That's the tragedy of it.
She was married.
He's a wonderful character. There's so many ones. Even the bad people
The doctor is awesome.
Yes.
He's...
But they all, even like you're saying, even the people like Levi
Levi.
At the same time, it's so moving when he's so furious about things that he's actually just so impotent about what his parents have done. All those generations have left him with this position. He becomes this bitter, horrible man. And you kind of feel bad for him, even though at the same time you're going, you're an asshole.
Yeah. That's sick.
When Fosse says, I'm not sleeping with you anymore. We've decided I'm not going to sleep with you anymore. His wife, that was
But that scene where his father's dying and he wants his will changed.
Yes. Well, you know where that's from.
And
that's blind. That's biblical.
Yeah, no, but I mean,
that's Isaac and
Esau. The scene where
it's actually Esav, if you want to know.
And Jacob.
Yaakov.
As I was saying, that scene with him and the wife, I got so mad.
I got so mad
at those people.
But it's a brilliant but it's a brilliant subversion because in the Bible, the whole thing is that Jacob is the hero, essentially, whereas Levi is not the hero.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a very interesting biblical subversion there, which is what he does throughout the whole book, to be frank. Yeah.
But I mean, it's just the way he can take these characters and he just makes you care about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without really, I don't quite know how he does it because at times they feel like more like sort of symbolic stand-ins for people rather than people. But then something will happen and it's like, oh, that's not good.
Well, and also the way that they'll speak to each other. So there'll be kind of scenes where they do seem a little bit more symbolic, but then you'll get to the end of a scene, like when the Widow Divine is talking to Lizzie and she goes, you really hate me, don't you?
Yes,
I do. And she goes, that's good, maid, because that means you'll remember me. And I was like,
That was a stunning.
I love Mary Trofina.
I loved Mary Trofina.
She was just fabulous.
When she died, I know this is spoilerific, but when she died, I was reading it on the bus and I just sat there weeping.
Yes.
On the bus.
No. Yes.
And I was like, why do I read these
things? You.
I know, but it was just the way that she was saying, I would die for a cup of tea, and they bring her the cup of tea. And then, aren't you going to drink it? I would really love to. And she can't move. I was just like, oh, God. I'm thinking, God, why do I read on the bus? I do this all the time.
No, it was fantastic. But I also noticed this afternoon when I was doing a bit of a reread on the plane. Well, I read it when I was overseas and I just went through.
Yeah.
But, and this is a huge spoiler, when Abel loses his memory, he's no longer referred to as Abel.
Yes.
For the rest of the book. So he becomes like Judah with that identity.
That
and he's.
Is that the point, though? Isn't the point that when Abel goes off the boat?
Yeah. And
the whole whale thing? Isn't that the whole cyclical.
No, but isn't it Patrick that goes off the boat at
the end?
It's Abel.
I thought the whole thing was to go. It's one of those cyclical books.
It is. It totally is.
But it's not. Like, I don't think Abel becomes. Judah.
Oh, I don't.
No,
know.
No, no, no. I don't think it's supposed. I think it's just supposed to really. I think it's a history repeating itself.
Yeah, it's
rather than actually tying it back.
But I didn't feel like he died. That was the other thing. I felt like he was going into the cycle again.
Well, because we've seen that already.
Yeah, which was.
I disagree. I know time travel. It's idiotic to think that this is a time travel novel. I know that, but it's just he purposely brings a whale into it.
Your genres are showing.
No, I
think he leaves it open to having that kind of hopeful interpretation at the end.
Yes.
I think we are led to believe that that could happen because we see Judah coming in the whale at the beginning. We see them talking about the Bible being thrown into the ocean.
Yes.
So the fact that he's doing the exact same things suggests that there is that kind of future hope for him. But I don't think it means he's going to come back as his great grandfather.
I think I can go with that the same thing will happen to him as happened to Judah. But I'm not going to stretch it as far as
that he's becoming Judah.
Because I don't think the text really supports that.
Michael, where are you? But it just doesn't work for me if it is that he washes up in a whale in 1930 something or other, or what, you know, or whatever it is.
But you're willing to believe that there is a time traveling TARDIS shaped whale, or whale shaped TARDIS that takes him back 200 years.
It's just that sense of the magic real, the mystical elements of that. It just happens that's you know, a little curve in space time, and he appears on.
I would think that'd be an awfully depressing ending.
If it was a time travel.
If it was the same guy just...
Well, I think that
it was all a dream. Over and over. And that would be about the most depressing ending I could think of.
If we look in the first chapter, he talks a lot about... He repeats this phrase, exit and entrance, entrance and exits a lot. Mm. So that's obviously going to be something, this kind of going in and out of things. So coming out of the whale, going down into the outhouse... You know, hole, and then coming back up out of the outhouse hole. And so it's the kind of thing where you think there's going to be lots of ins and outs. So I don't think it's a, and it's kind of feeling like circular history repeating itself, but it's more a in and out. So Abel goes into the ocean. We can then extrapolate and think he's going to go into some other sort of fantastical thing. Might not be a whale, but we can imagine it that way. I don't think it's tying back into now I'm going to become Judah.
If I thought he was going to become Judah, I would find that just a bit twee.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't think the book is pushing in that direction.
I don't know where you guys are coming from.
It's not Terminator, Ian. It's not Terminator.
It is. And I did doubt myself. I did say, Ian, it's not a time travel novel. That's not what this is all about. It's not, you know, the timey-wimey Stephen Moffat sort of thing at the end.
It's definitely not
it's
that.
It's just that he's making it very clear, as you said, throwing the Bible.
It's patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get
it's the, patterns
I get the whole
repeating.
Pattern thing, but,
and if you,
and he
if
stinks
you,
like a
yeah,
fish.
But the thing is, if you take... Because he's Judah's grandson.
Great grandson.
Yeah. No, but that's the thing. I think if you take that away, if you just say, oh, now he's going to become Judah and press reset, I think you rob the book of its
forward momentum.
Its idea of the importance of patterns and
history
cycles
and memory
and things happening. To say that it's not another iteration, but it's actually the same thing just happening again. That's quite different.
Because it always moves forward. That's the other thing with the book is that there's always progress and it always moves forward. But I think I said before why I hated 100 Years of Solitude was because the end of that book is basically the death of the entire family. And you've put a lot of investment into this book. No, I really wouldn't bother.
Spoilers!
Read Love in the Time of Cholera. But I didn't get grumpy with Galore because there was a sense of hope. And actually the point where I bawled, apart from Mary Trofina, was that moment where Esther thinks she's pregnant.
Oh, the
Hannah thinks she's pregnant too, but then the doctor says, oh, no, she can't possibly be. And you think, oh, my God, she's going to die. It's a tumor. Mm. Then you realise she is pregnant.
No, would you do?
Yeah.
No,
yes,
the last thing we're left with is, oh, God.
No, because she says to him, you told me I could never get pregnant again. And he says, medicine's not an exact science.
Yeah.
I thought he was just trying to, no.
Yeah,
I thought he was just trying to,
I thought he was just going, you're dying.
Yes.
And-
Yeah. I'm going to ease you into it.
I don't think...
No, because I don't think he's ever lied to anyone about...
I thought she was pregnant.
I thought she was pregnant.
No, I've got a huge bloody tumor.
He had never lied to anyone...
He would not tell her she was pregnant if she wasn't. About stuff.
I don't know. I'll have to look at it again. I thought it was I'm being kind to you and you're dying. Because all of the other babies that were born in the book, you hear about them. And this doesn't...
Well, actually, that's the last scene before Abel gets his...
Because you have to finish the book somewhere.
I know, but... I don't know. It seems to me that that is an ending, and that's why it's another Abel's going into the ocean. Like, he's actually finishing some things off, but still leaving the hope that Abel's going to come out of the ocean. I thought Esther also was done for.
So did I.
I think, no. What?
No, I didn't. I thought she was...
Because, as Angela said, that he's never
I want to look at it again. Yeah.
I had this great dip and then up, and, my mood swing was...
Sorry to pop that bubble for you.
I disagree with you, TARDIS whale. Harry man.
I also think... There is someone in the world who says, yes, Mondi's right.
It is a TARDIS whale.
It's a TARDIS whale.
Can you not take my brilliant...
Probably Stephen Moffat, and he's going to write that for the next Doctor Who episode.
He's already done Sky Shark, so why not? I also think that, like, Abel going into the ocean... It sort of rounds out. So I think that is an ending. Mm-hmm. It's sort of because we've come well into the 20th century now, mm-hmm. where the 20th century and industry and everything is pushing in to this world. Mm, yes. So that is sort of the end of something.
Yeah.
So Abel, I don't think Abel's going to come out of the ocean 10 years later and
no. because be reborn.
I think that closes something. It kind of closes that time.
But it does also feel like that around, I don't know, probably about 150 pages in, when Divine's widow dies, when that first generation of people die, it does feel like another kind of miniature ending. Like, obviously we still have another third of the book to go or whatever, but it feels like he does these kind of small acts, finishes them off, and then you get a new story with the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The one thing I kind of regret is a tiny thing, is that I really wish they hadn't put the family trees.
Oh yes, I agree. Because they're spoilers.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's like Judah marries Mary Chaffin. It's like, you don't find that out until you're meant to find that out. It's like, I didn't want to know that.
No, it's foreshadowed very early on.
Yeah, that's
it's
in
very,
the first
yeah, this is the man I'm going to marry.
Yeah, but
no, but it spoils a whole bunch of other marriages that you don't.
Yeah,
know
I mean,
happen.
It's stuff you.
It's like reading the blurb. You just don't look at it.
But they're there, and I went, okay. Fortunately, I should orient myself. Yeah.
Fortunately, on the Kindle, like all graphics, it's miniature, so you can barely read it. So I just ignored it. But I went and looked carefully at it afterwards. And I thought, oh, that was silly.
And it's kind of unnecessary.
I'm sorry, but that bit with the tumor baby, tumor slash baby,
tumor baby,
you could read it both ways.
We compromise, don't we?
It's a tumor baby. It's a tumor baby. It can be happy or sad.
We have a TARDIS whale and a tumor baby. Yeah.
Well, you know what it was.
So sorry, Mr. Crummy. We have reduced your book.
Newman straightened his tie, knocked lightly at Esther's door, letting himself in when he got no answer. She was asleep on the bed, dressed only in her nightshirt, and even from across the room he could see the remarkable distension of the belly, the tumour at least the size of a cabbage, he guessed. And then when she talks to him, "Hello, my love. You told me I'd never be able to get pregnant again, Dr. Newman." He shrugged. "Medicine is an inexact science," which is the line you said. But he shrugs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the thing I don't get. If he thinks she is actually pregnant, and she knows she's pregnant. Why do he sort of, you know?
It seems like he's sidestepping around her death when I read that. I feel like he's sort of just saying, I'm going to let you die, thinking you have actually achieved this miracle birth or miracle pregnancy.
Yeah.
But you're actually going to die.
See, I don't think that's his personality. I think he's always been quite brutally upfront with people. So I maybe I'm just
No, Harrison agrees with you, so it's two against two.
Well, but I think that makes it really interesting.
Actually, now that I'm reading it.
No, stay with me on the happy side.
The thing is, he held in his feelings for Bride for how many years?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
He is able to kind of...
Oh, we can't all on the podcast reread that bit.
Yeah,
I'm now thinking when Ian read that bit, I'd forgotten that in his... Like, this is sort of in his head, and he looks at her belly and says a tumour.
Mm.
And that's in his head.
Yeah, but see, so I think he moves that's... over closer and looks and...
Oh, well, you can't just tell from looking.
Now I'm thinking...
Unless you actually could see the kid kicking, which you can see on...
I'm thinking Ian and Lisa are probably right now because the tumour part is in his head. Like, he does look at her
and he's thinking it to himself.
Yeah. And then he is...
And that is the last moment we have with all those characters except
but
for
still,
Abel,
it's still nice because...
And becomes a whale TARDIS.
Whale TARDIS.
No, but it's still, like, there's still a nice scene because she asks him again, like, this recurring question ever since he got to the island, any regrets?
Any
and he
regrets?
Said, no, not a one. Oh, so it's still, so even even with his wife dying of cancer with a tumour as big as a cabbage, he still doesn't have any regrets.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really nice...
That's when I sort of got a bit cry.
Oh,
yes. Not I choose to believe she's pregnant.
She has a tumor baby.
But I can actually tell you why I bought this book at the Adelaide Writers Festival when they were doing the reading, and it was this sentence. If he's alive enough to shit, James Windy said, he's alive enough to walk.
Yeah,
and, I leaned over to Brain and said, I'm buying that book.
I am classy.
That's so true because he's just dumped a whole load.
Basically.
Of rainbow
shit. Make a rainbow shit. Yeah.
Make a joke about they fecal think matter and I will buy your book.
Note to self.
Oh, I have to say, that's one of the lines that got me very early on.
Well, I think that Michael Crummy was very astute in the passage that he chose
he
to read.
Read from the beginning of the book up, like the first page and a half, up to the point where Judah, who they've just pulled out of the whale, and they think he's just a corpse, and they're just getting
around with
the
his penis, flicking it around.
Yeah, yeah.
find out when erect is probably the biggest thing in the world.
Apparently, judging by the noises,
yes.
It was so
which
funny.
Is also hilarious. The whole fucking island, coast.
But no, so he read from that beginning, and they're taking what they think is a corpse up, and then there was the fecal matter joke, and that was funny. And then there's a line where he says, like Judah wakes up and gasps, and everyone goes, "Oh my god, he's alive!" And then he stopped reading, and I just went, oh, "No,
I
need to find out the next thing." I bought the book.
So
very clever man,
Canadian person in the room.
Yes.
How'd you pronounce it? Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland, not Newfoundland. Because
not
that
Newfoundland. It's Newfoundland.
Why would you first off put the accent?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's just the way it is.
Have you been seen? No.
No, I haven't.
Is it sort of like the Northern Territory of Canada that no one goes to, but there's a rock somewhere?
It's way over
No. It's not that far. I mean, obviously Canada is a huge country, as Australia is. But it's not – Newfoundland's just on the east coast. It's not like it's out in the middle of nowhere. But it's just – I don't know. It's maritimes, fishing community. The way that he describes it, obviously it's really metropolitan now and modern. But, I mean, it's not like a big holiday.
To death in winter.
People,
eating potatoes and salt.
Lots of people go there in the summertime, but it's not like a holiday destination. I don't know. That sounds so awful. Sorry, Michael Crummy, for bagging. The other thing is that Newfoundland is kind of like Tasmania more than the Northern Territory. So all of the jokes that people make about Tasmanians, that's the sort of jokes Canadians make about
what
Newfoundlanders.
Jokes, Lisa? We love our Tasmanians.
It's a loving joke.
Is it also a lot colder than the rest of Canada? Considering Canada's...
I'm going to blush again now.
Can you give us
No, it's not much colder than the rest of Canada. Canada's...
Can you give us a Newfoundland joke?
No.
She's not from Newfoundland.
But why are you pronouncing it properly suddenly? Because you're like, you knew Kirsten.
I did, actually.
And is it Labrador or is it Labradador?
Labrador. The way that you would think.
Henceforth, it shall be known as Labrador.
No, I have never been. My sister has gone there.
And?
I haven't. And she said it's beautiful. I would love to go there. I just... now live in Australia, and it's a lot longer to get back there.
So I'm tempted to buy Crummy's other works, but they're not on the Kindle.
For shame.
No, well, I'm also tempted to buy them as a book. I know, shock, shock. But You don't know anything about them?
I haven't read them. I've only read Galore. I did go to the Writers' Week tent to buy them after, and they were all sold out, so obviously quite popular in Adelaide.
Okay.
But no, I haven't
but
read
it
them.
Does say that this is the first one that has some sort of magic reel. Not that that's the only reason I'd buy the books.
The other ones are set in Newfoundland as well, as far as I know, but yeah, this one is more sweeping in its scope and has that
River,
kind of magical.
River Thieves won a whole bunch of awards, didn't it? That was like, not that wasn't his first novel, but it was his first novel that got a whole bunch of recognition.
Yeah, yeah. And then this one got the biggest. You know,
is
the
he a superstar in Canada?
I don't know. I've been here for 11 years now, so I don't know. I had,
but you know everything about Canada, Lisa.
I don't.
Actually, I should have guessed from your original story where you just found it in an airport. You thought you were already dead. You think Michael Crummy? Wow, he's got a new book.
No, Jesus, Michael Crummy. We're neighbors. We share stories about wart remedies,
whales that maybe TARDISes.
Oh, come on. That's what happened to Cyclical. Well, I got nothing more to say about the book. There's my segue.
But we all liked it.
I have to say that I absolutely cringed every time they mentioned Judas Smell.
I know.
Because I could imagine it. And
the stench of fish.
How disgusting it would be. And poor Mary Trefina.
But she goes and has been a nookie from time to time.
Well,
when the
urge gets...
I love that. When the urge... I just nip down to the shed.
Of course.
Yeah, and keep my husband. My fishy husband.
Of course. What happens to him?
It's
a mystery.
He just disappears.
It's a mystery. And the fact that Mary Trefina just keeps going to visit the shack every day until she dies.
That is heartbreaking.
It is. Except you don't. Well, so I don't think it made clear that she went to visit with him. We don't know when he went.
Exactly.
Like, where is it? Like, some of the people assume he must have gone years before and she just went keeping. Well, what if he went when she died? Mm-hmm. What if she was the only thing keeping him anchored to the place anymore?
Entirely possible.
And it's just when she died, he just went and everybody's thinking, well, he couldn't have gotten out now, so he must have been years. And
of course, he's always loved her. He was the one who wrote the lines to her.
I picked it early, though.
I didn't. Devastated.
I didn't pick that
and
early.
Her line that she was so angry she could taste nails in her mouth. She thought she would taste it all of the days left to her.
So angry.
And she does mention that again later, like chapters later, where someone says, aren't you hungry? And she's like, I'm just tasting nails.
Still pissed off.
So good.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. But no, I kind of...
It's that sort of book. It's very memorable.
Like,
we could talk about
it. I like to think that
it.
he just vanished when she died.
Yeah.
Like at the time of her death, he just wasn't there anymore.
But I love that he leaves it open so that you don't know and you can kind of invent what happens based on your reading
like
of the story.
Like the Bible.
Yeah.
I don't like how that story ended. Or I don't know how that story ended. I'm
going to make it up.
Yeah. Oh, what is
this
the doctor's
good.
Name?
Newman.
When Dr. That's right, I just read it out.
Newman.
When he's looking through the old Bible with such care. Oh, mm-hmm. There's so many good moments. Read this fucking book, people. Even if we've spoiled it.
So I don't think
but there's so much more. We've picked out some highlights. There's so much that
we haven't
just,
even touched on.
It is rich
I
and
love
varied.
That the Widow Divine is just the Widow Divine all the way through.
It. We never find out her name.
I want to say this once and for all. We're doing obviously three podcasts in the space of a week.
Yes.
We've mentioned that a number of times. This is the best thing I read.
Ooh.
Okay, admittedly I didn't entirely finish Alan Moore, but I'm getting that that probably was never going to hit my list. But of the seven books we were required to read.
Yes.
Including the one I chose, A Carter Witch, this, and including the memoir, this Galore was my favourite. Memoir probably comes, Caitlin Keenan, comes probably close second. Very close.
You know I'm always going to go with Caitlin Keenan.
Yeah, I know, but this was my favourite Galore. I adored this. I wish more. I could have done another 150 years, even though it would have been pointless. I could have done it.
It's a delight.
It is a delight.
Which the Alan Moore is not.
No.
The Alan Moore is not a delight. It is an exercise. But Galore is an absolute
delight.
But
that doesn't mean that Galore is just a sort of an airport novel.
No, I didn't buy it in the airport. I bought it at a bookshop before.
Whatever. Your story is, in my mind, an airport. It's not an airport novel. It's actually quite an in-depth, deep-meaning, beautiful book. But it is a delight. You're right. That is.
Yes.
Yes. That's my last word.
I think that's a good last word. So we've got four resounding yes votes for Galore.
Yes. How many votes did we have for Alan Moore's book?
Mm.
5 stars on Goodreads.
It was just me.
And three of us going, hate you, Alan Moore. We hate you.
And Angela, we're not sure about you at the moment.
No, no.
I stand by my decision, people.
Okay. Well, I think we are going to wrap up. So I will tell people to next episode, which will be the next episode, which you lovely listeners will be hearing, is episode 23, though it's not the next one we're going to be recording. Yes, so because we're actually not going to be recording it for 3 months, I get a reading holiday. Neither Ian and I have actually read the books we're recommending.
So they may be shit. So we're given. We're allowed for that episode to actually knock both those books.
But I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't think so either.
But I am. I'm not recommending, because I think that's the wrong word in this case. I have chosen to read and hope I will very much enjoy. And I'm quite confident that I will very much enjoy Bitter Greens by Kate Forsyth. And
I have chosen, blah, 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 everything the person said, even though this is not the first time I've done this, but whatever, Osama by Lavi Tidar.
Which I'm looking forward to reading, because that's been on my to-read list. So
that's what
good.
Guys now have 3 months to read.
Well, these two people
they're
here.
Doing the podcast
these
in
two
June.
Particular people here.
Yes, in the room, yes.
No, I'm just saying, because everyone else who's listening won't actually hear it until a month before, so sorry.
But they get to cheat. They're in a very privileged position, Lisa and Angela. They get to cheat and catch up if they really give a shit about the book before the podcast is on, because it'll be September's podcast.
This will be September's podcast.
This is August.
This is August.
It's August, right? Everyone.
Hello, future people.
I love Lisa's nodding. Yes, to confirm. Yes, it's August.
Nice. A message to Ian from the future. Don't have the mango jello stuff at the restaurant.
Where's that fucking whale? That's what I want to know.
All right. So we are wrapping up. We are saying to people that you can send us feedback. You can follow us on Twitter, Writer and Critic.
Do you follow us on Twitter, Writer and Critic?
Absolutely, we do.
Yeah, you do too. Well done. Yeah, I know you do. I wasn't sure about you, but thanks.
You can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or you can send us email, if people still do that these days, writerandcritic@gmail.com, or if you subscribe through iTunes and you've enjoyed what you've heard, you could leave us a rating of your choice. Oh, he hasn't said
No, you know
anything.
What I was thinking about?
What were you thinking about?
Whether we can get it to 6 stars.
Oh.
No, really what I was thinking about is, should we mention what we're doing in October? Have we done that yet?
I'm tired.
No, only because it's August when this goes out.
That's going to be the digital books.
Yeah, the e-books. We're doing 5 books.
If we read them and like them enough and we don't just pull another book out of our butt instead.
Oh, okay, so you don't want to announce what those 5 books are.
I don't have them with me, so that's impossible.
Because we're in a hotel room in the city.
That's right. Okay. Hello, future people. Yeah. Okay, so thanks for that, Ian. I might edit a little bit of that out.
Yeah, great. No, you don't have to. It was really good.
Shut up.
I think you should say that Galore was so good it went off the chisang and got a 6-star.
Your part of this podcast is over, Angela.
Oh, no.
What the fuck's a chisang?
The whole podcast is over. We're done.
Thank you so much. Lisa and Angela. Is there any final thing you want people to know about yourselves? You do realize you don't actually have a microphone in your hand.
Thank you for being such a gracious host.
Thanks.
And not poking fun at the less abled of us in the room.
What the?
The microphone challenge.
Oh, no, yeah. Right. No, we never do that.
Microphonically challenged. I like that.
It's been wonderful.
Yes.
And
thank you both so much. Thank you for recommending challenging and fun books. No, actually, like, for all of the stuff I said about the Alan Moore, I am glad I read it, because there were some stories in there that I really, really, really liked. So
we're at the end of the podcast. Don't butter her up now.
No.
You've had 95 minutes to do it. Bye. I'm done. See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You are not putting that in the pre-roll.